Listening Library presents Bud Not Buddy by Christopher Paul Curtis. Chapter 1. Here we go again. We were all standing in line waiting for breakfast when one of the caseworkers came in and tap, tap, tap down the line. Uh-oh. This meant bad news. Either they'd found a foster home for somebody or somebody was about to get paddled. All the kids watched the woman as she moved along the line, her high-heeled shoes sounding like little firecrackers going off on the wooden floor. Shoot. She stopped at me and said, "Are you Buddy Caldwell?" I said, "It's Bud, not Buddy, ma'am." She put her hand on my shoulder and took me out of line. Then she pulled Jerry, one of the littler boys, over. "Aren't you Jerry Clark?" He nodded. "Boys, good news. Now that the school year has ended, you both have been accepted in new temporary care homes, starting this afternoon." Jerry asked the same thing I was thinking. "Together?" She said, "Why, no. Jerry, you'll be in a family with three little girls." Jerry looked like he'd just found out they were going to dip him in a pot of boiling milk. "And Bud?" She looked at some paper she was holding. "Oh, yes, the Amoses. You'll be with Mr. and Mrs. Amos and their son, who's 12 years old. That makes him just 2 years older than you, doesn't it, Bud?"
"Yes, ma'am,"
she said. "I'm sure you'll both be very happy." Me and Jerry looked at each other. The woman said, "Now, now, boys, no need to look so glum. I know you don't understand what it means, but there's a depression going on all over this country. People can't find jobs, and these are very, very difficult times for everybody. We've been lucky enough to find two wonderful families who've opened their doors for you. I think it's best that we show our new foster families that we're very..." She dragged out the word "very," waiting for us to finish her sentence for her. Jerry said, "Cheerful, helpful, and grateful." I moved my lips and mumbled. She smiled and said, "Unfortunately, you won't have time for breakfast. I'll have a couple of pieces of fruit put in a bag. In the meantime, go to the sleep room and strip your beds and gather all of your things." Here we go again. I felt like I was walking in my sleep as I followed Jerry back to the room where all the boys' beds were jim-jammed together. This was the third foster home I was going to, and I'm used to packing up and leaving, but it still surprises me that there are always a few seconds, right after they tell you you've got to go, when my nose gets all runny and my throat gets all choky and my eyes get all stingy. But the tears coming out doesn't happen to me anymore. I don't know when it first happened, but it seems like my eyes don't cry no more. Jerry sat on his bed, and I could tell that he was losing the fight not to cry. Tears were popping out of his eyes and slipping down his cheeks. I sat down next to him and said, "I know, being in a house with three girls sounds terrible, Jerry, but it's a lot better than being with a boy who's a couple of years older than you. I'm the one who's going to have problems. A older boy is going to want to fight, but those little girls are going to treat you real good. They're going to treat you like some kind of special pet or something." Jerry said, "You really think so?" I said, "I'd trade you in a minute."
"The worst thing that's going to happen to you is that they're going to make you play house a lot. They'll probably make you be the baby and will hug you and do this kind of junk to you." I tickled Jerry under his chin and said, "Ga ga goo goo baby weepy." Jerry couldn't help but smile. I said, "You're going to be great." Jerry looked like he wasn't so scared anymore, so I went over to my bed and started getting ready. Even though it was me who was in a lot of trouble, I couldn't help but feel sorry for Jerry. I mean, not only because he was going to have to live around three girls, but also because being six is a real rough age to be at. Most folks think you start to be a real adult when you're 15 or 16 years old, but that's not true. It really starts when you're around six. It's at six that grown folks don't think you're a cute little kid anymore. They talk to you and expect that you understand everything they mean. And you'd best understand, too, if you aren't looking for some real trouble, 'cause it's around 6 that grown folks stop giving you little swats and taps and jump clean up to giving you slugs that'll knock you right down and have you seeing stars in the middle of the day. The first foster home I was in taught me that real quick. 6 is a bad time, too, 'cause that's when some real scary things start to happen to your body. It's around then that your teeth start coming loose in your mouth. You wake up one morning, and it seems like your tongue is the first one to notice that something strange is going on. 'Cause as soon as you get up, there it is, pushing and rubbing up against one of your front teeth, and I'll be doggone if that tooth isn't the littlest bit wiggly. Now, at first you think it's kind of funny, but the tooth keeps getting looser and looser, and one day, in the middle of pushing the tooth back and forth and squinching your eyes shut, you pull it clean out. It's the scariest thing you can think of, 'cause you lose control of your tongue at the same time, and no matter how hard you try to stop it, it won't leave the new hole in your mouth alone. It keeps digging around in the spot where that tooth used to be. You tell some adult about what's happening, but all they do is say it's normal. Well, you can't be too sure, though, 'cause it shakes you up a whole lot more than grown folks think it does when perfectly good parts of your body commence to loosening up and falling off of you. Unless you're as stupid as a lamppost, you've got to wonder what's coming off next. Your arm? Your leg? Your neck? Every morning when you wake up, it seems a lot of your parts aren't stuck on as good as they used to be. 6 is real tough. That's how old I was when I came to live here in the home. That's how old I was when Mama died. I folded the blanket and sheet and set them back on the mattress. Then I reached under the bed to get my suitcase. Now, most of the kids in the home keep their things in a paper or cloth sack, but not me. I have my own suitcase. I set it on the mattress and untied the twine that held it together. I did what I do every night before I go to sleep. I checked to make sure everything was there. The way there are more and more kids coming into the home every day, I had to make sure no one had run off with any of my things. First, I pulled my blanket out and saw that everything was where it was supposed to be. At the bottom of my suitcase were the flyers. I took the blue flyer out and looked at it again. The paper was starting to wear out from me looking at it so much, but I liked checking to see if there was anything I hadn't noticed before. It was like something was telling me there was a message for me on this flyer, but I didn't have the decoder ring to read what it was. Across the top of the flyer, written in big black letters, were the words "limited engagement." Then in little letters, it said, "Direct from an SRO engagement in New York City." Underneath that, in big letters again, it said, "Herman E. Calloway and the Dusky Devastators of the Depression." Those 6 exclamation points made it seem like this was the most important news anyone could think of. Seems like you'd have to be really great to deserve all those exclamation points all stacked up in a row like that. Next, the paper said, "Masters of the New Jazz." Then, in the middle of the flyer, was a blurry picture of the man I have a real good suspicion about. I've never met him, but I have a pretty good feeling that this guy must be my father. In the picture, he's standing next to a giant fiddle that's taller than him. It looks like it's real heavy, 'cause he's leaning up against it trying to hold it up. He looks like he's been doing this for a long time, and he must be tired, 'cause he has a droopy, dreamy look on his face. There are 2 men beside him, one playing drums and the other one blowing a horn. It wasn't hard to see what the guy who must be my father was like just by looking at his picture. You could tell he was a real quiet, real friendly and smart man. He had one of those kind of faces. Underneath the picture, someone had writ with a black fountain pen, "One night only in Flint, Michigan, at the luxurious 50 Grand, on Saturday, June 16th, 1932, 9 until?" I remember Mama bringing this flyer with her when she came from working one day. I remember because she got very upset when she put it on the supper table and kept looking at it and picking it up and putting it back and moving it around. I was only 6 then and couldn't understand why this one got her so upset. She kept four others that were a lot like it in a dressing table, but this one really got her jumpy. The only difference I could see between the blue one and the others was that the others didn't say anything about Flint on them. I remember this blue one, too, 'cause it wasn't too long after she brought it home that I knocked on Mama's bedroom door, then found her. I put the blue flyer back in the suitcase with the four older ones and put everything back in its place. I went over to the big chest of drawers and took my other set of clothes out and put them in the suitcase, too. I tied the twine back around my bag, then went and sat on Jerry's bed with him. Jerry must have been thinking just as hard as I was, 'cause neither one of us said nothing. We just sat close enough so that our shoulders were touching. Here we go again. Chapter 2. There comes a time when you're losing a fight that it just doesn't make sense to keep on fighting. It's not that you're being a quitter, it's just that you've got the sense to know when enough is enough. I was having this thought because Todd Amos was hitting me so hard and fast that I knew that the blood squirting out of my nose was only the beginning of a whole long list of bad things that were about to happen to me. Todd's next punch crashed into the side of my ear, and I fell on the floor and pulled my knees up to my chest and crossed my arms in front of my head like a turtle in a shell. I started scooching toward the bed, hoping I could get under it. Todd started kicking me, but his slippers couldn't hurt me near as much as his fists had. The bedroom door opened and his mother, Mrs. Amos, came in. It seemed like she was having a hard time figuring out what was going on, because Todd's right leg got tired from kicking me and he switched over to his left one while she watched. Finally, Mrs. Amos said, kind of soft, "Toddy?" Todd looked up, fell on his knees, and put his hands on his throat. He started huffing and puffing, with his eyes bucking out of his head and his chest going up and down so hard that it looked like some kind of big animal was inside of him, trying to bust out. This was my chance to get under the bed and pull the covers down so they couldn't see me. Mrs. Amos ran over to her son and fell on her knees. She put her arms around his shoulders. "Toddy, Toddy boy, are you all right?" She looked over to where I was peeking from under the bed. "You little cur, what have you done to Toddy?" Todd coughed out. "Oh, mother." He took in two jumbo breaths. "I was only trying to help." He was sounding like a horse that had been run too hard in the winter. And look what it's gotten me." Todd pointed at his jaw, and Mrs. Amos and me could both see a perfect print in the shape of my hand welted up on Todd's blubbery cheek. With one quick snatch, she had me from under the bed and out on the floor, laying down next to Todd. "How dare you? This is how you choose to repay me? Not only have you struck him, you have provoked his asthma!" Todd said,
"I just tried to waken him to make sure he'd gone to the lavatory, Mother. I was just trying to help."
He aimed his finger dead at me and said,
"And look at him, Mother. This one's got bedwetter written all over him."
I'm not bragging when I say that I'm one of the best liars in the world, but I got to tell you, Todd was pretty doggone good. It seemed like he knew some of the same things I know, the things that I think of all the time and try to remember so I don't make the same mistake more than 7 or 8 times. Shucks! I've got so many of them rememorized that I had to give them numbers, and it seemed like Todd knew number 3 of Bud Caldwell's rules and things for having a funner life and making a better liar out of yourself. Rules and things, number 3. If you've got to tell a lie, make sure it's simple and easy to remember. Todd had done that. But this wasn't really a good test, because Mrs. Amos had her ears set to believe anything Todd said. In her eyes, Todd's mouth was a prayer book. But I can't blame Todd for lying like that. Having someone who likes you so much that they think everything you say is the truth has got to be a liar's paradise. That might feel so good it can make you want to quit lying. But maybe not, because Todd hadn't quit lying since the second I came to his house. What had really happened was that I woke up from a good sleep because it felt like a steam locomotive had jumped the tracks and chug-chug-chugged its way straight into my nose. When I jerked up in bed and opened my eyes, Todd was standing next to me with a yellow pencil in his hand. He was looking at it like it was a thermometer and said, "Wow, you got all the way up to R." He turned the pencil toward me, crunched up against the headboard. I saw Ticonderoga printed on the yellow wood. The whole room smelled like the rubber from the eraser, and I was winking and blinking my left eye because it felt like something had poked the back of my eyeball. Todd laughed. "I've never gotten it in as deep as the inn on any of you other little street urchins. I just might enjoy your stay here. Who knows what other things you could be number one in, buddy?" I'd already told him twice that my name was Bud, not Buddy. I didn't care that Todd Amos was 12 years old. I didn't care that he was twice as big as me, and I didn't care that his mother was being paid to take care of me. I wasn't about to let anybody call me Buddy and stick a pencil up my nose all the way to the R. I swung as hard as I could at Todd's big balloon head. Somewhere between the time I threw my punch and the time it landed, my fist came open, and when my hand landed, it made a pop like a .22 rifle going off. Todd fell on the floor like he'd been cold-cocked. He sputtered and muttered and felt the spot where I'd slapped him. Then a big smile came on his face, and he stood up and started walking real slow toward where I was on the bed. He untied his robe and dropped it on the floor like he was getting ready to do some hard work. I jumped to the floor and got my fists up. Todd might have been a lot bigger than me, but he'd better be ready. This wasn't going to be a bird's nest sitting on the ground for him. He could kiss my wrist if he thought I was going to let him whip me up without a good fight. Being this brave was kind of stupid. Even though Todd was a puffy, rich old mama's boy who wore a robe and slippers he could hit like a mule, and it wasn't too long before I decided enough was enough. But the story that Mrs. Amos was hearing from her lying son was only that Todd had tried to wake me up so I could go to the bathroom. Mrs. Amos hated bedwetters more than anything in the world, and my bed had a sticky, hot, smelly rubber baby sheet on it. She said it wasn't anything personal, and after I had proved myself for 2 or 3 months, I could get a proper cloth sheet. But until then, she had to protect her mattress. She pulled Todd to his feet and led him to the door. She looked over at me. "You are a beastly little brute, and I will not tolerate even one night with you under my roof. Who knows what you would be capable of while we slept?" The door shut behind them, and I heard a key jiggle in the lock. I plugged the right side of my nose and tried real hard to blow the smell of rubber out of the left side. The key jiggled in the lock again. This time, when the door opened, Mr. Amos was standing with Mrs. Amos. He was carrying my suitcase. Uh-oh. They'd looked inside. I could tell because the twine that held it together was tied in a kind of knot that I didn't know. This was wrong. They'd promised they'd keep it safe and not look in it. They'd laughed at me when I made them promise, but they did promise. "Boy," Mrs. Amos said, "I am not the least bit surprised at your show of ingratitude. Lord knows I have been stung by my own people before. But take a good look at me, because I am one person who is totally fed up with you and your ilk. I do not have time to put up with the foolishness of those members of our race who do not want to be uplifted. In the morning, I'll be getting in touch with the home, and much as a bad penny, you shall be returning to them. I am a woman of my word, though, and you shall not spend one night in my house." She looked at her husband. "Mr. Amos will show you to the shed tonight, and you can come back in tomorrow for breakfast before you go. I do hope your conscience plagues you, because you may have ruined things for many others. I do not know if I shall ever be able to help another child in need. I do know I shall not allow vermin to attack my poor baby in his own house." She talked like this, and she wasn't even a preacher or a teacher. Shucks, she talked strange like this, and she wasn't even a librarian. I only halfway listened to what Mrs. Amos was saying. I was too busy keeping my eye on my suitcase, wondering if they'd stolen anything from it, and thinking about getting even. When I thought she was done talking, I reached my hand out for my suitcase. But she told Mr. Amos, "Oh, no, We shall hold on to his beloved valuables, she laughed. This shall be our assurance that nothing comes up missing from the house and that this little animal is still here in the morning. He is far too attached to those treasures to go anywhere without them. Mrs. Amos was one of those grown-ups who could always think of one more thing to say. And that is not all. Before you retire to the shed, you shall go to Todd and apologize, or I shall be forced to give you the strapping of your life. I had been so worried about my suitcase that I didn't even notice the thick black razor strap hanging out of Mrs. Amos's hand. She didn't have to worry. I'd apologize. One beating from those Amoses was enough for me. She grabbed my arm. Mr. Amos walked out of the room with my suitcase, and Mrs. Amos pulled me down the hall to Todd's room. We stood outside the door, listening to Todd groan. When Mr. Amos came back, my suitcase was gone. He'd been so quick that I knew my bag couldn't be too far away. She tapped on Todd's door and said, "Toddy, may we come in?" Todd's groans got a little louder. Finally, he said,
"Yes, Mother." "Come in."
We opened the door, and as soon as he saw me, Todd got a real terrified look on his face. He scooched up to the headboard and wrapped his arms around his head. Mrs. Amos gave me a shake and said, "Well?" I put my head down and started shooting apologies out like John Dillinger shoots out bullets. I aimed at Todd first. "I know it was wrong of me to hit you. I know you were only trying to help, and I'm very sorry for what I did." I looked at Mr. Amos. "And, sir, I'm sorry that I got you out of your sleep." He rolled his eyes like that was enough for him. Mrs. Amos was going to be the hardest, because just like her ears were set to believe everything that came out of Todd's lips, they were set not to believe anything I said. And if I didn't lie good enough, she was going to use that strap on me. These Amoses might look like a bunch of cream puffs, but if she was anything like Todd, I bet she could pack a real wallop.
"And, Mrs. Amos, I'm so grateful for all of your help, and I'm really, really sorry."
I looked up and could see she needed more.
"If you give me another chance, I promise I'll do a whole lot better. Please don't call the home. Please don't send me back."
Shucks. Going back to the home was just what I wanted to do. But I was being just like Br'er Rabbit in one of the books Mama used to read to me at night when he yelled out, "Please, Br'er Fox, don't throw me in the prick-a-patch. Please, please." This was another one of Bud Caldwell's rules and things to have a funner life and make a better liar of yourself. Rules and things, number 118. You have to give adults something that they think they can use to hurt you by taking it away. That way, they might not take something away that you really do want. Unless they're crazy or real stupid, they won't take everything, because if they did, they wouldn't have anything to hold over your head to hurt you with later. Now, I stopped talking and gave Mrs. Amos a chance to jump right in. She held her hand up in my face and said, "Enough. Mr. Amos, give him the blanket and pillow off the bed he was in and put him in the shed." Todd said, "Yeah, buddy, keep a sharp eye out for the vampire bats in the shed." It was like a miracle. Todd's asthma was gone, and he turned into a real chatterbox. "Oh, and watch out for those spiders and centipedes, buddy. The last kid who got put in there got stung so bad he was swole up as big as a whale when we got him out in the morning." I guess I didn't look scared enough, because Todd kept going. "The kid before that hasn't been found to this day. All that's left is that big puddle of his blood on the floor. Isn't that right, Mother?" Mrs. Amos said, "Now, Toddy, hush up. You'll just tire yourself out more." I noticed that she never denied the things Todd had said about the vampires and centipedes and spiders and puddles of blood. As I followed Mr. Amos, I kept a sharp eye out for my suitcase. When we got to the kitchen, the first thing I saw was that there was a double-barreled shotgun leaning against the side of the icebox. I didn't have time to wonder why they'd be so scared they'd keep a big gun like that out in the open, because I spotted my suitcase slid way under the kitchen table. I didn't let Mr. Amos know I'd seen it, but it did make me get a lot calmer. We went out of the back kitchen door and down the steps into the dark. We walked around to the back of the shed, and he put a key in a padlock. A chain rattled. The lock came off, and the door creaked open. Even though it was nighttime, there was a whole different, scarier kind of dark in the shed. A colder dark, with more grays and more shadows. An old smell leaked out, and it seemed like it was the perfect smell that all this gray would have. Mr. Amos nudged me, and I took a baby step into the shed. He could kiss my wrist if he thought I was going to beg him and say things like,
"I'll do anything you folks ask me if you don't lock me up in here all alone."
I squeezed my tongue between my teeth to hold it still, because I know a lot of times your brain might want to be brave, but your mouth might let some real chicken sound and stuff fall out of it. I stood a little bit inside and looked around. Right under the window was a pile of stacked wood. There was a bunch of dusty spider webs in front of the little window, and someone had pasted old yellow newspapers over the glass so the kids who got locked in here couldn't peek out. Mr. Amos handed me the blanket and pillow and gave me another nudge. I took two more baby steps in. I looked down at the floor. If I was like a normal kid, I would have busted out crying. But I just stood there breathing hard. It was a good thing I'd bit my tongue, because I came real close to saying those stupid begging words to Mr. Amos. Right in the middle of the floor, there was a big black stain in the dirt. They really were going to make me sleep in a shed with a patch of blood from the kid who had disappeared out of here a couple of weeks ago? The floor went completely black when Mr. Amos pulled the door shut. I couldn't see it now, but I'd rememorized the exact shape the stain was in. The padlock snapped shut with the loudest click I'd ever heard. Chapter 3. The only thing I could hear was my own breath. It was so loud that it sounded like there were six scared people locked up in the shed. I closed my eyes and thought real hard about making my breathing slow down. Pretty soon, it sounded like the five other breathers in the shed had left. I was still scared, but now it was that get real excited and want to move around kind of scared. It didn't take too long for my eyes to get used to the dark. There was a gray gas can in one corner next to a bunch of gray rakes, and a pile of gray rags, and a gray tire next to some gray fishing poles. Maybe Mr. Amos had only pretended to lock the door. I reached my hand toward the gray doorknob, and quick as that, I went from kind of calm to being in that stand-in-one-place with spit drooling down the front of your shirt kind of scared. Halfway up the door were three little flat monster heads guarding the doorknob. Each head had two little round eyes staring right at me. The eyes were the only thing in the shed that weren't gray. They were a bright yellow with a big black spot right in the middle. I dropped my blanket and pillow and backstepped until my legs hit the woodpile behind me. From all the fast breathing going on, you'd have thought the five other scared people had come back and brought a couple of scared friends with them. Each head had a wide-open mouth with a sharp set of pointy teeth and lips smiling back, ready to bite. It felt like the shed was getting smaller and smaller, and the little mouths were getting closer and closer. Then I knew what I was looking at. The doorknob guards were three dried-out fish heads that someone had nailed to the door. I ran over to the pile of rags and poked at one of them with my shoe to make sure there weren't any rats or centipedes hiding under it. Then I picked it up and hung it over the fish heads so I couldn't see them and they couldn't see me. I picked up my blanket and pillow and had to decide what was the best way to sleep. Now, I knew the floor was no good. I'd have bet all sorts of bugs and roaches were crawling around. I remember what happened to my best friend Bugs when a cockroach crawled in his ear one night at the home. Four grown folks had held Bugs down whilst they tried to pull it out with a pair of tweezers, but the only thing that did was pull the roach's back legs off. When they were digging around in Bugs's ears with the tweezers, you'd have thought they were pulling his legs off, not some cockroaches. I'd never heard a kid scream that loud. After about 15 minutes of Bugs screaming the joint down, they said they were going to have to take him to the emergency room to get the roach out. It was almost morning when Bugs got back. Everyone was asleep, except me. I waited until they put him in his bed and turned off the lights. I said, "Did they get it out?" He said, "Oh, hi, bud. Yeah, they got him." "Did it hurt a lot?" "Nope.
Were you scared?
Nope.
Then how come you were screaming so doggone loud?
He said, I didn't know I was. I probably couldn't hear me screaming because that roach was so loud.
I'd seen lots of roaches, but I'd never heard one of them make any sound. I said, loud how?
Well, bugs ain't so different from us as you think.
Soon as he saw those tweezers coming at him, he was pretty terrified and commenced to screaming. Screaming in English, too. Not some bug language like you'd expect from a roach.
Yeah?
What'd he say?
All he kept yelling was, my legs! My legs! Why have they done this to my legs?
That's the true story about how bugs started getting called bugs. I'd bet $1,000 that there were roaches on the floor of this shed just a-waiting to crawl in someone's ear. And I'd bet those Amoses wouldn't even try to pull a roach out. And who knows how long I'd have had to listen to some terrified roach screaming his head off right up against my eardrum. I spread the blanket on top of the woodpile and climbed up on it. Now, this put me so I was even with the window. I took a piece of bark and brushed all the spider webs from in front of the window. Then I put my hand on the glass to see if the newspaper was pasted on from the inside or the outside. I touched paper. I spread my fingers, and my hand looked like a yellow jacket bumblebee, bright yellow with black stripes. This was a great place to have shadow puppets, so I made my hand be a wolf and a dog and a duck. After a while, that got to be pretty boring. So I scraped at the paper with my fingernails so I could see outside. But I like to keep my nails bit down real low, and the paper didn't budge. I took out my jackknife and tried scraping the newspaper with it. The paper peeled away in little curly strips, like that stuff rich people throw on New Year's Eve. I finally got a hole big enough to look out and mashed my eye up against the glass. I could see the back of the Amos house real clear. There was a light on. That had to be Mr. and Mrs. Amos's bedroom. The little bit of light that came through the hole in the paper made me get calm enough that I could lay my head on my pillow and take a nap. When I blinked my eyes open, the first thing I noticed was that the light from the Amos's bedroom was out. The next thing I noticed made me wish I'd stayed asleep. Up at the very top of the shed was the biggest vampire bat you'd ever see. He was hanging upside down asleep, but the smell of me rising up to him would probably wake him up at any minute. I reached over to the window and tried to slide it open. It budged an inch. I rolled off the woodpile and crawled toward the door with the fish head guards. I reached my hand up and the doorknob turned. Mr. Amos was trying to help me, but after the door opened a crack, the padlock and chain on the outside held it tight. I looked back up into the rafters to see if the bat had woke up. He was still sound asleep. Just like there's a time that a smart person knows enough is enough, there's a time when you know you've got to fight. I wasn't about to let this vampire suck my blood dry without a war. He could kiss my wrist if he thought that was going to happen. I got up off my knees and picked up the gray rake. I walked over to the woodpile, cool as a cucumber, but inside, every part of my guts was shaking. I stood up on the woodpile and held the rake like it was a Louisville slugger. I eyed where the bat was sleeping and revved the rake like I was going to hit a 400-foot home run. Just before I swung, I remembered another one of Bud Caldwell's rules and things for having a funner life and making a better liar out of yourself. Rules and things, number 328. When you make up your mind to do something, hurry up and do it. If you wait, you might talk yourself out of what you wanted in the first place. Shucks, I couldn't remember for sure if you killed a vampire by driving a stake in its heart or by shooting it with a silver bullet. If I was wrong and didn't kill the bat right away, I was going to be trapped in the shed with a vampire who was probably going to be real upset that someone had woke him up by whacking him with a rake. I took my jackknife out of my pocket and pulled the blade open. That way, if I didn't kill him with the rake and it came down to the two of us tussling on the floor, well, maybe a silver blade in his heart would be just as good as a silver bullet.
unless that was what you had to do with werewolves.
I raised the rake over my head again, closed my eyes, and swung it like I was Paul Bunyan chopping down a tree with one blow. I felt the rake jerk a little when it hit the bat, and I opened my eyes just in time to see the vampire get cut right in half. I was kind of surprised it didn't scream or cry or say, "Curses, you got me!" Instead, the only sound I heard was a kind of rattling, like a couple of pieces of paper rubbing together or like dry leaves blowing around in the wind. The next sound I heard was even worse than if the vampire had said, "Aha, you doggone kid, that hurt, but now I get my revenge." It sounded like I'd turned on a buzzsaw in the shed. All of a sudden, it felt like someone had stuck a red-hot nail right into my left cheek. My hand reached up to grab my cheek, and I felt something creepy and prickly there. I brought my hand back down, and it was holding the biggest, maddest hornet I'd ever seen. I squeezed my hand shut to crush it, but it got in another sting on my palm. What I'd thought was a vampire bat hanging on the ceiling was really a hornet's nest, and now there were about 6,000 hornets flying around in the tiny shed, and each and every one of them was looking for me. Another fire nail went into my knee, and a second one went into my sock. Maybe this was why the other kid that they found in here had been as big as a whale. He was swole up from all the hornet stings. I dropped my shoulder down and charged at the door with all my might. The door banged against the lock but didn't budge an inch. All that happened was the rag I'd covered the fish heads with came off, and I got bounced back and landed square on the floor. I jumped up again. This time when I charged the door, I put my hand out like Paul Ropes and running down the football field. This wasn't a real good idea. I forgot all about the fish head door guards. My fingers went right into the mouth of the biggest one, and his little needle teeth cut me like a razor. I pulled my hand back and screamed. Another hornet buzzed into my ear, and it felt like someone had poured hot wax right down into my brain. The only thing I could think to do was jump on the woodpile and bust the glass out of the window. I grabbed the handles of the window and gave them one more jerk. I guess being scared gives you a lot of strength, because this time the window flew open with a loud bang. Three hornets found me at the same time, and all four of us fell out the window. As soon as we hit the ground, I rolled as far away from the shed as I could go. I smacked and whacked the hornets that had taken a ride on me and just laid there until I could catch my breath. After a while, the stings and the fish guard bite quit hurting so much. I started getting madder and madder. I was mad at the Amoses, but most of all, I was mad at me for believing there really was a vampire in the shed and for getting trapped like this where there wasn't anybody who cared what happened to me. I simmered down and started thinking about getting even. I wonder how hard I'd have to pull the trigger on that double-barrel shotgun for it to go off. I sneaked up the back porch steps to get inside the house. Maybe the vampire bat didn't say it. But the only thought on my mind was, "Aha, you doggone Amoses, that hurt. But now I get my revenge." Chapter 4. They hadn't locked the kitchen window. It slid open with just a couple of squeaks. Then I was inside the Amos house, crouched down like a cat burglar. Quick as a rabbit, I looked under the table to see if they'd moved my suitcase. It was still there. I got a whole lot calmer when I picked it up, and it was the right weight. I didn't think they'd taken anything out of it. I couldn't be sure until I looked inside, but I could do that later. I took in a deep breath and looked over at the icebox to see if the shotgun was still there. I let all the air out in a big puff when I saw it. Shucks. You'd think that with the Amoses being so doggone mean, they'd worry about leaving a big old shotgun like that out in the open. What if one of their visitors got real mad at them about something? I unlocked the back door and set my suitcase on the first step of the porch so I could make a quick getaway after I was through paying these Amoses back. I opened the screen door real quiet and went back into the house. Fair is fair. The Amoses deserve what they were going to get. I can't all the way blame Todd for giving me trouble, though. If I had a regular home with a mother and father, I wouldn't be too happy about other kids living in my house either. Being unhappy about it is one thing, but torturing the kids who are there, even though they don't want to be, is another. It was my job to make sure that other kids who didn't know where their mothers and fathers were didn't have to put up with Todd. My heart started jumping around in my stomach as soon as I reached out for the shotgun. It was a lot longer and heavier than I thought it would be. I lifted it and felt how solid the smooth brown wood was against my shoulder. With it up close to my face like this, I could smell the gray metal of the barrel and the gun oil Mr. Amos used on it. I aimed the gun at the stove and pretended I was shooting at an elephant or a dragon or a tiger or, best of all, Todd. I imagined how it would feel to creep up to his bed while he was sleeping and put the shotgun barrel right in his nose. After that, I'd have to do some quick moving to get the grown-up Amoses. Unless they were real sound sleepers, the shotgun going off in Todd's room would give them a clue that something was going on. I lowered the gun. These things were just too dangerous to play with or to take chances with. That's why the first part of my revenge plan was to get this gun out of the way. If something went wrong and the Ameses woke up, I didn't want them rushing down to the kitchen to get the gun. I knew they'd shoot me in a flash and tell the home it was an accident. I took the gun outside and put it on the back porch in a corner where they wouldn't be able to see it until daytime. I felt a lot better when it was out of my hands. When I was back in the kitchen, I started opening cupboards looking for the drinking glasses. The first one I opened had the jelly jar they'd given me to drink out of at supper time. I walked over to the sink and turned on one of the spigots. These Amoses had hot water running right into the house. I let it run for a second to warm up and put a dish rag in the bottom of the sink so the splashing wasn't too loud. When the water was good and hot, I stuck the jelly jar underneath until it was filled to the brim. I started down the hall. Todd's door came open easy as anything. I tiptoed over to his bed. He was deep asleep, and his hands were crossed on his chest like he was ready for the graveyard. I dipped my middle finger in the water. It felt like the perfect temperature. I held my breath and picked up one of Todd's chubby hands. One of the older boys at the home told me if you dip someone's hand in a warm glass of water whilst they're asleep, they don't have any choice but to pee to bed. It's something about chemistry and biology making some valve in your guts open up and whoop, zoop, sloop, you got a wet bed. I started to dip Todd's fingers in the water, but I couldn't dip more than two fingers at a time. Todd's bed stayed as dry as the desert. I tried holding Todd's hand flat and pouring water over it, but he still didn't wet the bed. Finally, I decided to just pour the water on his pajama pants. I pulled a blanket and sheet down and emptied the jar. His face twitched a couple of times, and for a minute it looked like his eyes was going to come open, but they stayed shut. He smiled, and the warm water from the jelly jar opened that little valve up, and whoop-zoop-sloop, he soaked his sheets. I tiptoed out of the room and down the hall and out the door. My favorite saying in the whole world is, "He who laughs last laughs best." So I put my hand over my mouth and whispered. I picked up my suitcase and walked to the street. Man, I was on the lam. I was just like Public Enemy Number One. If J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI saw me now, I'd be in some real serious hot water.
Chapter 5.
Being on the lam was a whole lot of fun. For about 5 minutes. Every time my heart beat, I could feel the blood pushing hot and hard on the inside of my sting spots and the bite on my hand, but I couldn't let that slow me down. I had to get out of this neighborhood as quick as I could. I knew a nervous-looking, stung-up kid with blood dripping from a fish-head bite and carrying an old raggedy suitcase didn't look like he belonged around here. The only hope I had was the North Side Library. If I got there, maybe Miss Hill would be able to help me. Maybe she'd understand and would be able to tell me what to do. And for now, I could sneak into the library's basement to sleep. It was a lot later than I'd ever been up before, and I was kind of scared of the cops catching me. I had to be real careful, even if it was the middle of the night, even if I was crouching down, sneaking along the street like Pretty Boy Floyd. At the library, I walked past a row of giant Christmas trees that were planted on the side of the building. There was a door on the side with a light burning above it, so I kept walking in the shadows made by the big trees. When I got to the back windows, I almost busted out crying. Somebody had gone and put big metal bars on the windows. Even though I knew it was useless, I tried tugging at the bars, but they were the real McCoy, solid steel. I headed back to the Christmas trees. They were low enough to the ground that no one could see me unless they were really looking, so I started opening my suitcase. Most folks don't have sense enough to carry a blanket around with them, but you never know when you might be sleeping under a Christmas tree at the library, so I always keep mine handy. I untied the strange knots that the Amoses had put in my twine and opened the suitcase. I could tell right away that someone had been fumbling through my things. First off, whenever I put the blanket in, I always fold it so that it stops all the other things from banging up against each other. But those doggone Amoses had just stuffed it in without paying no mind to what it was mashing up against. I lifted the blanket out and saw that everything else was still there. You might be able to say that the Amoses were some mean old nosy folks, but you couldn't call them thieves. I picked up the old tobacco bag that I kept my rocks in. I could tell by the way the drawstring was pulled that the Amoses had been poking through this, too. I jiggled it up and down in my hand a couple of times, and it felt like none of the rocks was missing, but I opened it to count them anyway. None of them was gone. Next, I pulled Mama's picture out of the envelope I kept it in and held it so the light from the library side door would shine down on it. It looked like the Amoses hadn't heard it. This was the only picture of Mama in the world. Running across the top of it was a sign that was writ on a long, skinny flag. It said, "Boys and girls, follow the gentle light to the misbegotten Moon Park." Underneath the sign, between two big wagon wheels, was Mama. She was about as old as I am now and was looking down and frowning. I can't understand why she was so unhappy. This park looked like the kind of place where you could have a lot of fun. In the picture, Mama was sitting on a real live little midget horse. It looked tired and dragged out like those big workhorses do, but it had a teeny tiny body with a big sag where most horses have a straight back. Mama was sitting right in the middle of the horse's back, riding him side saddle. Except there wasn't any saddle, so I guess you have to say she was riding him side sag. She had two six-shooter pistols in her hands, and the way her face looked, you could tell she wished she could have emptied them on somebody. And I know who that somebody was. Mama told me it was her father, my granddad. He'd gone and ruined everybody's fun that day by getting in a big fight with my mother about the gigantic white 25-gallon Texas cowboy hat that she was wearing. Mama used to tell me, "That hard-headed man insisted, mind you, that I wear that horrible hat." The hat was almost as big as Mama, and you could see it was fake, because as tall as it was, no real cowboy could have wore it without getting it knocked off his head every time he rode under a tree or some telegraph wires. Mama told me that some man used to drag the midget horse all through her neighborhood with a camera, and if your mama or daddy signed a piece of paper, he'd take some pictures of you, then come back in a couple of weeks so you could buy them. Mama wasn't looking like she had rocks in her jaw because the hat was so fake that a real cowboy would have laughed you out of town for wearing it. She was mad because the hat was so dirty. When she used to tell me about it, her eyes would get big and burning, like the whole thing happened the day before yesterday instead of all those years ago. She'd start moving around our apartment real quick, picking things up and putting them back in the exact same spot. "Filth," she'd say about the hat. "Absolute filth. Why, the thing was positively alive with germs. Who knows what type of people had worn it?" I'd say, "I don't know, Mama." She'd say, "Who knows how many years it had been worn by who knows how many sweaty little heads?" I'd say, "I don't know, Mama." She'd say, "The entire band on the inside was black, and I'm sure it was crawling with ringworm, lice, and tetters. I'd say, yes, Mama. She'd say, and that horrid little photographer didn't care. Do you imagine it ever occurred to him to wash it? I'd say, no, Mama. She'd say, of course not. We meant less to him than that horse he mistreated so. I'd say, yes, Mama. She'd say, but your grandfather insisted. To this day, I cannot understand why. But he insisted. Insisted. I'd say, yes, Mama. We had that conversation a lot of times. Me and Mama having the same conversation lots of times is one of the main things I can remember about her now. Maybe that's because when she'd tell me these things, she used to squeeze my arms and look right hard in my face to make sure I was listening. But maybe I remember them because those arm-squeezing, face-looking times were the only times that things slowed down a little bit when Mama was around. Everything moved very, very fast when Mama was near. She was like a tornado, never resting, always looking around us, never standing still. The only time stuff didn't blow around when she was near was when she'd squeeze my arms and tell me things over and over and over and over. She had four favorite things to tell me. One of them was about the picture, and another one was about my name. She'd say, Bud is your name, and don't you ever let anyone call you anything outside of that either. She'd tell me, especially don't you ever let anyone call you Buddy. I may have some problems, but being stupid isn't one of them. I would have added that D-Y onto the end of your name if I intended for it to be there. I knew what I was doing. Buddy is a dog's name, or a name that someone's going to use on you if they're being false friendly. Your name is Bud, period. I'd say, okay, Mama. And she'd say, every single time, and do you know what a bud is? I always answered, yes, Mama. But it was like she didn't hear me. She'd tell me anyway, a bud is a flower to be. A flower in waiting, waiting for just the right warmth and care to open up. It's a little fist of love waiting to unfold and be seen by the world. And that's you. I'd say, yes, Mama. I know she didn't mean anything by naming me after a flower, but it's sure not something I'd tell anybody about. Another thing she'd tell me was, don't you worry, Bud. As soon as you get to be a young man, I have a lot of things I'll explain to you. That didn't make me calm at all. That was Bud Caldwell's rules and things to have a funner life and make a better liar out of yourself, number 83. Rules and things, number 83. If adults tell you not to worry and you weren't worried before, you better hurry up and start, 'cause you already running late. She'd tell me, these things I'm going to explain to you later will be a great help for you. Then Mama'd look hard in my face, grab a hold of my arms real tight, and say, and Bud, I want you always to remember, no matter how bad things look to you, no matter how dark the night, when one door closes, don't worry, because another door opens. I'd say, what, it opens all by itself? She'd say, yeah. It seems to. That was it. Another door opens. That was the thing that was supposed to have helped me. I should have known then that I was in for a lot of trouble. It's funny how now that I'm 10 years old and just about a man, I can see how Mama was so wrong. She was wrong because she probably should have told me the things she thought I was too young to hear, because now that she's gone, I'll never know what they were. Even if I was too young back then, I could have rememorized them and used them when I did need help, like right now. She was also wrong when she thought I'd understand that nonsense about doors closing and opening all by themselves. Back then it really scared me because I couldn't see what one door closing had to do with another one opening unless there was a ghost involved. All her talk made me start jamming a chair up against my closet door at night. But now that I'm almost grown, I see Mama wasn't talking about doors opening to let ghosts into your bedroom. She meant doors like the door at the home closing, leading to the door at the Amos's opening, and the door in the shed opening, leading to me sleeping under a tree getting ready to open the next door. I checked out the other things in my suitcase, and they seemed okay. I felt a lot better. Right now, I was too tired to think anymore, so I closed my suitcase, put the proper knots back in the twine, crawled under the Christmas tree, and wrapped myself in the blanket. I'd have to wake up real early if I wanted to get to the mission in time for breakfast. If you were 1 minute late, they wouldn't let you in for food.
Chapter 6
Uh-oh. My eyes opened, and I could see the sun behind the branch of a Christmas tree. I jumped up, folded my blanket inside my suitcase, hid it, and started running the 6 or 7 blocks down to the mission. I turned the corner and said, "Phew!" There were still people lined up waiting. I started walking along the line. The end was a lot further away than I thought. The line turned all the way around 2 corners, then crossed over 1 street before I saw the last person. Shucks! I walked up to get behind him. He said, "Line's closed. These here folks are the last ones." He pointed at a man standing next to a woman who was carrying a baby. I said, "But, sir," he said, "but nothing. Line's closed. These here folks are the last ones." It was time to start line. If I didn't get any food now, I'd have to steal something out of someone's garbage, or I wouldn't be able to eat until the mission opened for supper. I said, "Sir, I..." The man raised his hand and said, "Look, kid, everybody's got a story and everybody knows the rules. The line closes at 7 o'clock. Now, how's it fair to these people who've been here since 5 o'clock that you can sleep until..." He looked at his wristwatch. "Until 7:15, then come busting down here expecting to eat. You think you got some kind of special privilege just 'cause you skinny and raggedy? Look in the line. Lots of folks look just like you. You ain't the worst. Supper starts at 6 p.m., but you see how things is. Now, if you plan on getting fed, you better be in line by 4. Now, get out of here before I get rough with you." Shucks. Being hungry for a whole day is about as bad as it can get. I said, "But..." He reached in his pocket and pulled something out that looked like a heavy black strap and slapped it across his hand. "Uh-oh. Here we go again," he said. "That's it. No more talk. You open your mouth 1 time too many. You rotten kids today don't listen to no one, but I'ma show you something that'll improve your hearing." He slapped the strap on his hand and started walking toward me. I was wrong when I said being hungry for a day is about as bad as it can get. Being hungry plus having a big knot on your head from a black leather strap would be even worse. I backed away, but only got 2 steps before I felt a giant warm hand wrap around my neck from behind. I looked up to see whose doggone hand was so doggone big and why they'd put it around my neck. A very tall, square-shaped man in old blue overalls looked down at me and said, "Clarence, what took you so long?" I got ready to say, "My name's not Clarence, and please don't choke me, sir. I'll leave." But as soon as I opened my mouth, he gave my head a shake and said, "I told you to hurry back. Now where you been?" He gave me a shove and said, "Get back in line with your mama." I looked up and down the line to see who was supposed to be my mama, when a woman pointed her finger at her feet and said, "Clarence, you get over here right now." There were 2 little kids hanging on to her skirt. I walked over to where she was, and she gave me a good hard smack on the head. Shucks! For someone who was just pretending to be my mama, she sure did slap me a good one. I said, "Ow!" The big square man who grabbed my neck looked at the man with the strap and said, Boy had to go use the crapper. Told him not to waste time, but like you said, these kids today don't listen to nobody. The strap man looked at the size of the man who called me Clarence and walked back to the end of the line. When the overall man got back in line, I said, "Thank you, sir. I really tried to get..." But he popped me in the back of the head hard and said, "Next time, don't be gone so long." The two little kids busted out laughing and said, yeah. Clarence got a lickin', Clarence got a lickin'. I told them, "Shut up and don't call me." Then both my pretend papa and my pretend mama smacked my head. She looked at the people direct behind us and said, "Mercy, when they get to be this age." The people weren't too happy about me taking cuts in the line. But when they looked at how big my pretend daddy was, and they saw how hard him and my pretend mama were going upside my head, they decided they wouldn't say anything. I was grateful to these people, but I wished they'd quit popping me in the head. And it seems like with all the names in the world, they could have come up with a better one for me than Clarence. I stood in line with my pretend family for a long, long time. Everybody was very quiet about standing in line. Even my pretend brother and sister and all the other kids. When we finally got around the last corner and could see the door and folks going in, it seemed like a bubble busted, and people started laughing and talking. The main thing people were talking about was the great big sign that was hanging over the building. It showed a gigantic picture of a family of four rich white people sitting in a car driving somewhere. But you could tell it was a family, because they all looked exactly alike. The only difference amongst them was that the daddy had a big head and a hat, and the mama had the same head with a woman's hat, and the girl had two big yellow pigtails coming out from above her ears. They all had big shiny teeth and big shiny eyes and big shiny cheeks and big shiny smiles. Shucks, you'd need to squint your eyes if that shiny family drove anywhere near you. You could tell they were rich, 'cause the car looked like it had room for 8 or 9 more people in it, and 'cause they had movie star clothes on. The woman was wearing a coat with a hunk of fur around the neck, and the man was wearing a suit and a tie, and the kids looked like they were wearing $10-a-piece jackets. Writ about their car, in fancy letters, it said, "There's no place like America today." My pretend daddy read it and said, Well, you got to give them credit. You wouldn't expect that they'd have the nerve to come down here and tell the truth. When we finally got into the building, it was worth the wait. The first thing you noticed when you got inside was how big the place was and how many people were in it and how quiet it was. The only sound you could hear was when somebody scraped a spoon across the bottom of their bowl or pulled a chair in or put one back, or when the people in front of you dragged their feet on the floor, moving up to where they were spooning out the food. After we'd picked up our spoons and bowls, a lady dug a big mess of oatmeal out of a giant pot and swapped it down into our bowls. She smiled and said, "I hope you enjoy." Me and my pretend family all said, "Thank you, ma'am." Then a man put two pieces of bread and an apple and a big glass of milk on your tray and said, "Please read the signs to your children. Thank you." We all said, "Thank you, sir." Then we walked past some signs someone stuck up on the wall. One said, "Please do not smoke." Another said, "Please eat as quickly and quietly as possible." Another one said, "Please be considerate and patient. Clean up after yourself. Your neighbors will be eating after you." And the last one said, "We are terribly sorry, but we have no work available." My pretend daddy read the signs to my pretend brother and sister, and we all sat at a long table with strangers on both sides of us. The oatmeal was delicious. I poured some of my milk into it so it wouldn't be so lumpy and mixed it all together. My pretend mother opened her pocketbook and took out a little brown envelope. She reached inside of it and sprinkled something on my pretend brother's and sister's oatmeal, then said to them, "I know that's not as much as you normally get, but I wanted to ask you if you minded sharing some with Clarence." They pouted and gave me a couple of dirty looks. My pretend mother said, "Good," and emptied the rest of the envelope over my oatmeal. brown sugar.
Shucks, I didn't even mind them calling me Clarence anymore. I said, thank you, Mama, ma'am. She and my pretend daddy laughed, and he said,
it took you long enough to catch on, Clarence.
He acted like he was going to smack me again, but he didn't. After we'd finished all our food, we put our bowls up, and I thanked my pretend family again. I asked them, are you going to be coming back for supper?
My pretend mama said,
no, dear. We only come here mornings, but you make sure you get here plenty early. You hear? I said, yes, mama. I mean, ma'am.
I watched them walking away. My pretend brother looked back at me and stuck out his tongue, then reached up and took my pretend mother's hand. I couldn't really blame him. I don't think I'd be real happy about sharing my brown sugar and my folks with any strange kids either.
Chapter 7. I pushed the heavy door open and walked into the library. The air in the library isn't like the air anywhere else. First, it's always cooler than the air outside. It feels like you're walking into a cellar on a hot July day, even if you have to walk up a bunch of stairs to get into it. The next thing about the air in the library is that no other place smells anything like it. If you close your eyes and try to pick out what it is that you're sniffing, you're only going to get confused, because all the smells have blended together and turned themselves into a different one. As soon as I got into the library, I closed my eyes and took a deep breath. I got a whiff of the leather on all the old books, a smell that got real strong if you picked one of them up and stuck your nose real close to it when you turned the pages. Then there was the smell of the cloth that covered the brand new books, the books that made a splitting sound when you opened them. Then I could sniff the paper, that soft, powdery, drowsy smell that comes off the pages in little puffs when you're reading something or looking at some pictures, a kind of hypnotizing smell. I think it's that smell that makes so many folks fall asleep in the library. You'll see someone turn a page, and you can imagine a puff of page powder coming up really slow and easy until it starts piling on the person's eyelashes, weighing their eyes down so much that they stay down a little longer after each blink, and finally making them so heavy that they just don't come back up at all. Then their mouths come open, and their heads start bouncing up and down like they're bobbing in a big tub of water for apples. And before you know it, whoop, zoop, sloop, they're out cold, and their face thunks down smack dab on the book.
That's the part that gets the librarians the maddest. They get real upset if folks start drooling in the books, and page powder or not, they don't want to hear no excuses. You got to get out. Drooling in the books is even worse than laughing out loud in the library, and even though it might seem kind of mean, you can't really blame the librarians for tossing drooly folks out, because there's nothing worse than opening a book and having the pages all stuck together from somebody's dried-up slobber. I opened my eyes to start looking for Miss Hill. She wasn't at the lending desk, so I left my suitcase with the white lady there. I knew it would be safe. I walked between the stacks to see if Miss Hill was putting books up. Three doggone times I walked through the library, upstairs and down, and couldn't find her. I went back to the librarian at the lending desk. I waited until she looked up at me. She smiled and said, "Yes? Would you like to retrieve your suitcase?" She reached under the desk. I said, "Not yet, ma'am. Could I ask you a question?" She said, "Of course, young man. How may I help you?" "I'm looking for Miss Hill." The librarian looked surprised. "Miss Hill? My goodness, hadn't you heard?" Uh-oh. That's number 16 of Bud Caldwell's Rules and Things for Having a Funner Life and Making a Better Liar Out of Yourself. That's one of the worst ones. Rules and Things, number 16. If a grown-up ever starts a sentence by saying, "Haven't you heard?" get ready, because what's about to come out of their mouth is going to drop you head first into a boiling tragedy. It seems like the answer to haven't you heard always has something to do with someone kicking the bucket, and not kicking the bucket in a calm, peaceful way, like a heart attack at home in bed either. It usually is some kind of dying that will make your eyes buck out of your head when you hear about it. It's usually the kind of thing that will run you out of a room with your hands over your ears and your mouth wide open. Something like hearing that your grandmother got her whole body pulled through the wringer on a washing machine, or something like hearing about a horse slipping on the ice and landing on some kid you went to school with. I answered, "No, ma'am," and got my stomach ready to hear about Miss Hill biting the dust in some way that was going to give me nightmares. The librarian said, "There's no need for you to look so stricken. It's not bad news, young man." She laughed a quiet librarian-type laugh and said, "Really, it's not bad news, unless you had matrimonial plans concerning Miss Hill." I pretended I knew what she was talking about. Most times, if you listen to how grown folks ask a question, they let you know what it is they want to hear. I said, "No, ma'am, I didn't plan that at all." She laughed again and said, "Good. Because I don't think her new husband would appreciate the competition. Charlemagne, Miss Hill is currently living in Chicago, Illinois." I said, "Husband? You mean she got married, ma'am?" The librarian said, "Oh, yes. And I must tell you, she was radiating happiness." I said, "And she moved all the way to Chicago?" "That's right. But Chicago isn't that far. Here, I'll show you." She reached under her desk and pulled out a thick leather book called Atlas of the United States of America. She thumbed through a couple of pages and said, "Here we are." She turned the book to me. It was a big map of Michigan and a couple of the states that were next to it. "We're here," she pointed to the spot that said Flint, "and Chicago is here in Illinois." They looked pretty close, but I know how tricky maps can be. Shucks, they can put the whole world on one page on a map. So I said, "How long would it take someone to walk that far?" She said, "Oh, dear, quite a while, I'm afraid. Let's check the distance." She reached under the desk and pulled out another thick book called Standard Highway Mileage Guide, and turned to a page that had a million numbers and city names on it. She showed me how to find Chicago on the line that was running across the page, and Flint on the line that was running down the page, and then to look at the number that was writ where the two of them joined up. It said 270. She pulled a pencil out and said, "Okay, this is how one figures the amount of time required to walk to Chicago. Now," she pulled a third book out. Shucks, this is one of the bad things about talking to librarians. I asked one question, and already she had us digging through three different books. She thumbed through the book until she said, "Aha, it says here that the average male human gait is 5 miles an hour. Okay, assuming that you could cover 5 miles an hour, all we have to do is divide 270 by 5. She did it and said, 54 hours. Much too long to be practical. No, I'm afraid you'll simply have to wait until Mrs. Rollins comes back to Flint for a visit. Shucks. Chicago might as well be 1,000,000 miles away from Flint. And Miss Hill might as well be a squashed, scrunched-up mess in a washing machine when it came down to helping me now. I thanked the librarian for the bad news and went to sit at one of the big, heavy tables so I could think what to do next. Going back to the home was out. It used to be that we'd get a new kid every once in a while, but lately it seems like there's a couple of new kids every day, mostly babies, and they're most always sick. It's not like it was when I first got there. Shucks, half the folks that run it don't even tell you their name and don't remember yours unless you're in trouble all the time or getting ready to move out. After a while, I got my suitcase and walked into the regular air and stinking smells of Flint. That library door closing after I walked out was the exact kind of door Mama had told me about. I knew that since it had closed, the next one was about to open. I went back under my tree, and before I knew it, I was asleep.